Bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by WiredTree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Hello and welcome to the Weird Things podcast. I'm Ader Main, joined by Brian Brushwood.
Hello, beautiful people.
Justin Robert Young.
Hello.
Mr. Bryce Castillo.
Hey, that's me. Hi, everybody.
So this is kind of cool. We've talked a bit before about, you know, electric airplanes and electric vehicles, you know, flying. And the trouble has been, and my criticism, and not just me, but other people, is like, they're noisy. You know, they're very, very noisy. And that the idea that we're going to have thousands of these things flying overhead sounds cool until you realize that it's like having, you know, 10 million lawnmowers overhead. It's just an extreme noise problem. The company Kitty Hawk, which is, I believe, one of the ones backed by, Larry Page of Google, and he's got like two different ones he's backed, and it's also part of a co-founder of X, which is the Google / Alphabet's Moonshot Factory, has been working on their own like vertical takeoff and lift and whatever you have aircraft. And they just released a video showing their new electric vehicle called Heaviside. That's heavy, but with H-E-A-V-I-S-I-D-E, which is supposed to be much more quiet. And they showed this with a demo showing this thing take off, and they compared it to like a helicopter, which is maybe not exactly, you know,
not exactly
my
silent
metric I use for, but we're looking at it here, and it only carries one person, but it's electric operated. And they're having it take off in this nice looking field. And
do you guys have a strong sense of whether you would trust a electric vehicle in the air more or less than a petroleum fueled one?
The advantage of gas powered airplanes is that we have, you know, 100+ years of research and, you know, figuring out how you deal with all the different sort of problems that then go wrong. And we have engines and systems that are, you know, you look at a modern 747, it has not changed much in, you know, 40+ years or whatever of that, because I mean, it has it's improved dramatically for reliability. You know, the shape and design, the engines have just gotten better and better and better. That's my fear.
I'm with you on that. The counter thought experiment would be, let's imagine that reliability or track record was less of an issue. All things being equal, would you like a flying vehicle that is powered by electricity that spins a thing, and that's the whole story, or would you prefer a vehicle that has this Rube Goldberg set of explosions happening thousands of times per minute that causes pistons to go up and down, that cause levers to do and causes rotors to turn? Like, it's funny because I'm with you. Like all things being equal, I'm more skeptical or cautious about the idea of hopping in an electric-powered vehicle for flight. But intrinsically, it seems like the electric one should be the safer, more obvious option.
This is the example of kind of like perfect being the enemy of good, right? Because you're right. I mean, that would be a similarly simpler option, but we have a gigantic backbone of our economy based on this one thing. So inherently that will be safer until it's not.
Well, and also like you trade off, you know, the electric theoretically has mechanical simplicity, but it has a higher level of complication when it comes to all from the batteries to the motors to everything else, where you've got thousands of little subsystems or computer systems, things like that running there, which again, we'll test these things. This will be the only way we want to fly in the future. Let me make that very clear. But I was saying with like an airplane engine is like, you've got a few parts. We know what these things are. We've flown these things under so many different conditions of like, oh yeah, never use this kind of rubber for your fuel line because above 40,000 feet, it freezes. Don't do this. Don't do that. So we know a lot of the do's and don'ts. And it's a much more simple system than an electric craft is. So I don't know. I early on, I want to watch a lot of RoboFlex.
Oh, so that's interesting. So it sounds like we might be kind of in agreement that at some point the electric system will feel like the safer one. So now it becomes a question of of how long, 10 years, 15, 50 years. That's interesting. I don't really have an answer for that.
And I don't, well, the advantage, the beautiful thing about electrical systems, and these are, is that you can run, you'll be able to run thousands of test flights without pilots.
Yeah.
Ooh. You could just, and that's, you'll be able to test these things in ways you couldn't. And the problem we had now, like you take the, you know, the, was it the 737 Max was, you can do simulators of this thing, you can do this sort of thing, but you ultimately, it's a system you have to test with pilots inside or to figure out, you know, what happens or what doesn't happen. And now there's rumors of, like, you know, fuselage problems. And it's not like you can just fly those things up in the air empty and put them through all these different things to see what goes wrong. With electrics, theoretically, you could.
So right now on the video, I guess I missed it the first time. What exactly is the decibel difference between the electric versus gas power? So 60 decibels for a gas...
For a helicopter, a 1,500 feet overhead versus 38 decibels for the heavy side.
Wow. And that's big enough for a person to be in there, huh? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they're like saying that like 150 feet above you, you barely notice it, that it's very quiet.
Yeah, so, we've talked a little bit about, I don't know if we've talked about it in this context, but as a kid, one of the memories I have a lot of is hearing planes overhead. As an adult, I almost never hear planes overhead. And at first I thought, oh, maybe planes get quiet or whatever. But of course, what I realized is, no, I live near cities and roads, and those sounds get drowned out by other closer sound things. Whereas on this 7-acre property, when you walk, there's a good like 200 foot elevation differential from the top part to down, you know, the secret backwoods area. And when you get down there, it's really remarkable because I noticed that I just never noticed the sound of jet planes. And then now that I do, I obsessively check, oh, that's Southwest headed to Vegas. That's American headed to LAX. I think it's really interesting. The sounds that defined my childhood, I almost never hear except for when I go to those spots where it drowns out all the competing sounds.
You know, was going for a walk last night and walking along, passed by some high tension power lines, right? And it was late at night, it's very quiet, it's Burbank, and you hear all of a sudden you could hear that the Star Wars blaster sound, which is how they got it, of the ding ding sort of
it's
thing.
It's like a branch hitting that tension line.
But there's no branches, it was just the wind and just the vibrations from them overhead, you know, and there was like this sort of like guitar strings being plucked. And it was sort of this low, very subtle sound. And I walk by there tons of times. I've never noticed that before, but I heard it last night. I'm like, oh, wow, that's interesting because it's this it's spooky sound late at night. And then I had this epiphany. I'm like, what is this like in an earthquake? I bet you it changes its tone. And I'm like, man, I wonder if that's what sets off dogs and cats and stuff in an earthquake is high tension lines absorbing the vibrations from, you know, that at first and then starting to, you know, so... I haven't even bothered to look that up.
This is the beauty of being a suspense novelist is that if you were a scientist, you'd have to test and find out if you're right. You don't have to. Like, that's a good enough idea that you can put it in a book and just decide it's part of that universe. I love this.
Literally, the next conversation I had with my girlfriend was, and I'm going to have Theo Cray say this in a book and I get to put it out there.
Hey, by the way, let's also just take a moment right now because Andrew, speaking of Theo Cray, you got a new Theo Cray book out this week, right?
Yes. Dark Pattern, of which I have a copy. Here we go. Hey, look, every audio listener. Dark Pattern, the brand new Theo Cray book number 4. Listen, Theo is an incredibly talented guy, but I've been planting sort of the idea that Theo's own self-assessment may not always be accurate.
So far, we've seen him, I don't want to say lucky, because obviously he's a smart guy and things seem to work out, but not that you have to give out spoilers, but it sounds like you're hinting what, like he's been expecting to strike out at some point, and maybe we see that in this book?
I'm saying that he's a very smart person, and he's dealt with challenges that somebody of his particular intellect is able to make insight into. But what happens when he's not? What happens when, ooh, you know, he deals with chaos? So
So in other words, previous books, he's been right because stuff has been sensible and that there is a consistent answer or pattern to be discovered. What happens if there's just not? What happens if and forgive me, this is me speculating. What happens, for example, if you have a serial killer who goes to random.org and truly makes sure to remove any possible human biases from his killings?
Yeah, or, you know, there's a concept, and I don't get too much into it, but when you want to develop a machine learning model, there's a thing called overfitting, which, if you think about the word, it's pretty much what it means. It's like, if I train a model to recognize faces and I give it 100 faces to say these are the test faces, I might make a model that's really good at recognizing only those faces. You know, and that's what you have to be careful of to make sure your model's good at picking up faces and not just specifically those faces, et cetera. So, you know, and that's the kind of thing that you have is, you know, confirmation bias, things like that, all this sort of stuff. So it's a little bit of a kind of a background into what's going to go on with Theo there. So
very cool.
And available when?
Tomorrow.
Are you 15th, able to pre-order on Audible?
Sure. I don't know. I'll take your money.
I'm gonna type that in. Dark patterns.
Just me a roll of nickels. It's fine. It's good. I'll tell
it
them.
It does seem that Brian's Amazon will let you spend a credit on it.
Oh, yeah. No. You can pre-order.
But yeah, it comes out on the 15th. Yeah. So if you're listening to this on or after the 15th, it's out now.
Yeah, it's out now. Go do it. And I'll tell you what, everybody absolutely should. While they're also supporting us at patreon.com/weirdthings. If you like this show, make sure you keep it going. Patreon.com/weirdthings is the place where you can do exactly that. You could also get our After Things podcast in its own feed before anybody else. Oh, it's so good. Patreon.com/weirdthings.
Yay. And by the way, Dark Pattern is the number one new release in medical thrillers, which
hells yeah.
I didn't know that I set out to write a medical thriller, but...
And yet here you are, the king of medicine.
Wrap up. Anybody wants to check it out, take a look at the Kitty Hawk and then Heaviside. I'm excited because I have been very negative about electric airplanes and stuff. Well, the noise. And they're like, well, Andrew, we listened to your podcast.
Yeah.
And we solved the problem because you're the only one to bring that up. No, but I'm thrilled to see this thing that I've been dismissive about that's a problem they've been solving and working on. And I like it when I'm like, nah, I don't think it'll work. And I'm wrong.
So. It's also a light enough kind of glidey looking craft that I feel like if all of the engines were to just, you know, whatever EMP crap the bed, I don't know how the flaps are controlled, but I feel like I could picture it gliding to a safe stop if need be.
Yeah, I'm sure they have some glide ratio. Of course, if it's all fly by wire electric controls, I don't know. But you know, I parachute systems, things like this, they get into it's a new area, because also some of these are designed to not have pilots, so it's not like you have somebody who knows how to fly by stick and control and bring this thing down. You know, it's like if I'm in one of these things and it goes, it shuts down, I can't even remember how to restart my iPhone, so I'm dead.
Man, I guess it would make sense. Do they have emergency parachutes where you don't even have to yank the cord? Like that's the one job that would give me anxiety. If you just told me, I'm seeing Zach Holder here in studio, nod his head. Like you just put on the thing and just jump, and then a thing will notice you're falling, and then
there are parachutes like for like skydivers that do automatically go off at a certain point if you have not already pulled it.
Yeah. Wow.
Or you have Tom Cruise rescue, like in Fallout, which was awesome. You see that movie, Mission Impossible Fallout?
I think I did.
Yes, we did.
We went and saw it together. I acknowledge it was very well crafted. And
yeah, fair enough. it was a great parachute sequence there. All right, so we have a email. This is from Jeremy, and I responded to him, but I wanted to bring this up because it was actually, I think, for everybody here. And he says, hey, guys. Well, I just added that. Says, I didn't catch us getting covered by you guys at all and was hoping to hear your collective opinions on the matter with regard to videos published on YouTube in 2004 and 15. They have confirmed that they are UFOs. And this was, we talked about this back a while back, which was the Navy UFO stuff and some of these sightings, which the Navy's like, we're not sure what they are, you know, which is not the same as saying it's aliens. And then the Navy actually had sort of an issue internally about, no, we didn't mean to, we did or didn't, whatever. But anyhow, the videos are out there and, you know, that we know the videos are probably very likely authentic. It says, what I would also recommend is the Joe Rogan podcast. 1316 is not a fan of him or his show, but this is a must listen for UFO enthusiasts. Commander David Fravor is on that episode, which was the pilot of the plane that recorded the 2004 video. He recounts what he saw with his eyes, something you can't see in the sensor footage, which, just Andrew speaking here, that's always a little warning sign. I'm going to tell you what's not on the video that I can't back up. But anyhow, he explains in detail the other odd happenings in the ocean, discusses gravity propulsion and so much more. Here's a link to the video. Blah, blah, blah. Says, I just want to end. Okay, so putting that out there, we've talked about this before, but let me finish it off. He says, I want to end with a crazy thought of my own. What if at one point here on Earth we had a high civilization? Let's say they were either spacefaring or deep sea faring. If the last major cataclysm was the Younger Dryas impact 12,000 years ago, there's a possibility a portion of that civilization survived by escaping space or underwater. And the slate was wiped clean of their existence here on the planet's surface. Steel and silicon would be dust in 12,000 years. The resulting split would leave in heavy surviving humans on the planet left in the Ice Ages technology-wise. What if we are the results of the survivors left in the Ice Ages? What if these UFOs are simply our more advanced brothers? If aliens are out of the question, then the answer would have to be humans. Anyway, sincerely love the show. I can need to listen to when you guys are heads in jars.
Let's pretend just for a second that somebody's listening to this podcast and has literally no idea what you're talking about at all. So let's start with first fundamentals. There was in 2004 and I guess again in 2015 some released footage or leaked footage of what appeared to be people flying what F-15s or something, very confused by the motions of something flying around.
Yes.
And for the audio listeners, I think it's safe to sum up as you get a black and white video and something's moving crazy and you have a voice of a guy saying, I don't understand how this thing's moving. It's moving crazy. In other words, kind of the same thing that we've seen in the 1960s, 1950s, right?
Yeah. And, you know, I guess the point to the question was, is we could try to take apart these videos, which there's a hell of a lot to unpack, which Joe Nichols done a pretty cool, in my good explanation of what's going on there. And I was going to get to more to the point of, we don't know what these things are. We don't know the explanation for this is, but, and before we jump to a 12,000 year old civilization, you know, that's because that was the either, I think I like Jeremy's enthusiasm, but the either or, like, hey, here's a video of something we don't understand. What if maybe it's not aliens, maybe it's this, it's like, or maybe it is just a simple phenomenon that.
Okay, we're still jumping ahead. So there are these videos.
Go wherever you want, Ryan.
What's that?
Go start wherever you want.
I prefer to start at the beginning. So there are the videos, and then the new news is that they've been confirmed to be from the military. They're not frauds or fakes. These were real encounters. They quote unquote confirmed that we encountered a thing that we don't know what it is. That's the new news, right?
Yes. I mean, that circa weird things a few months ago. Yes.
Got it. Okay. And so now the question is from our reader is speculation. And forgive me, it went by really fast and it was hard for me to hear. But it sounds like the question is, let's take aliens from another starfaring galaxy off the table and instead speculate that maybe these are humanity's cousins that have been growing up in parallel somewhere nearby.
Yes.
And so where are you at on that hypothesis?
The point I was trying to get to is that we can have footage of weird things. We don't quite know what they are. And we've had this and talked about this before where, you know, I've seen footage like, I don't know what it is, but to jump from the assumption of, I don't know what this is to, hey, must be alien or must be some flying craft or some kind or some super technology is a problematic leap for me. In the case of Fravor, who's the guy who's out there who said this, you know, there's been a, you know, some other investigative stuff that said very simple explanations of like, you know, yeah, they're watching a surfacing submarine. This was probably a balloon, whatever. And I don't know. I'm not qualified to say, yes, this explanation's true or not. But, you know, you have to have that category of, I don't know. You know, because we found these things before where we go like, I can't explain it. And then we're like, oh, no, it's a different kind of flare. Like, oh, wow, that flare is real. Okay, got it. I guess that's what it is.
I guess that is the question that I think we oftentimes sort of skip over in these conversations is just like, all right, from the very beginning, before we even look at any evidence, how much, like what percentage of just random noise is just going to be unidentifiable?
Mm-hmm.
Because there has to be something. We can all agree that like, all right, well, between the weather and the instrumentation and whoever eyes are on it or videotape is recording it, that there's going to be 1%, 2% of encounters where you're just seeing something where it's like, man, I got nothing. I have no idea. And it could be any number of explanations, but they are just going to be something that we can't put a solid definition on. And that's what I feel like this is, although I will say, if we can indulge for a few seconds, the idea that, like, what would be more likely that there was a spacefaring civilization on Earth that was then wiped away and now, you know, they're, you know, visiting back home versus there's another civilization beyond the stars that is coming to visit Earth. I would say that I would find the former more likely than the latter.
So the challenge with that explanation, and he says that, like, you know, silicon and steel would be ground to dust, whatever, that's not necessarily likely to be true. We can still see the impact from the Romans' lead refineries. You know, we find the pollution strains, we can see where they did that, we can look and see the environmental damage from that. We just found a 40,000-year-old bracelet that belonged to a Denisovian. A 40,000-year-old bracelet, we find this. You know, we have these archaeological finds where we find arrowheads, we find all these things, I have a Neanderthal flint next to me that is, you know, 200,000 years old. We find all of this. Screwdrivers and stuff like this, other materials, we would find some things, you know, bricks or other remnants of the civilization, if it was a high-tech, large-scale civilization. That should, by all accounts, there should be some, you know, when you talk about a certain degree of level, that stuff sticks around.
Yeah.
There's none of that. None of that. So
what if they build their entire civilization out of paper?
Well, that's, we talk about that, but that's one of the problems we have in trying to do archaeology in the tropics or other places where they used wood and bamboo. And, you know, there are a lot of places where we don't know what was there because, you know, these things sort of eroded away. I'll tell you, a friend of mine is Paul Hynek, who is the son of J. Allen Hynek, who the TV series Project Blue Book's based upon, that Steven Spielberg got the rights for Close Encounters from. And Hynek's theory was he had a problem with, because Hynek was an astronomer, Hynek had a problem with the idea of aliens coming from other star systems because of just the distances bothered him. They bothered him. And he thought that he looked at all these cases for Blue Book and said that they closed it before really answering these things. And there were so many of them that couldn't be explained. And this is coming from Paul Hynek, or his father, but I don't know. But he said that his theory was, you know, was interdimensional travelers. And I don't know if that explanation works any more well for me than, you know, aliens.
And it's like, oh, yeah, there's like, you know, these gigantic distances between us and another solar systems. I guess we don't. It's harder for us to quantify the distance between dimensions. So I guess theoretically, I guess it could seem closer. But certainly we know how to get from one place to another. And as soon as we got ourselves into space, we could at least by our elementary standards say, okay, yeah, just more power this way. And eventually we're going to get there. Sure, we'll all be dead, but like, you know, based on our lifespan, but we know technically what that is. I guess that is just like the bias toward the unknown, right? That like the unknown will always be slightly easier for us than something that we know is extraordinarily difficult.
Yeah. And, you know, it may not be one explanation fits everything. Like, you know, we had a Trident missile launch you know, a few years ago out over near LA out there in the, and it looked amazing and it looked supernatural, looked spooky, looked like some sort of big alien phenomenon. And then we're like, we find out what it is. And you might see things like, you know, you see things with no sense of scale, and it could be this, could be that, could be, you know, could be, you know, could be weather balloons, could be these things, could be a lot of different things. And we're trying to find the one explanation where it's a lot of weird stuff going on. And I'm open to anything, aliens, whatever. Sure. I'm just going to go for whatever best fits what we know. And first is, we're not good observers. There you go, Jeremy.
I'm with you, Jeremy. I'm you know, look, I understand Andrew makes a lot of valid points about the fact that it'd be really hard to hide a spacefaring civilization on Earth. But that being said, paper mache. Just think about that. Checkmate, Theus.
So last is two unrelated stories are kind of related, which was some researchers said that there was in 1964 an outbreak of apparently like a deadly fungus, and what they think caused it was a tsunami, basically, which caused a bunch of water vapor, et cetera, airborne spores, which just affected these trees and then caused this big problem around basically, I think, areas of the Pacific Northwest. And I thought this was such an interesting idea of, you know, what could be causing, you know, a deadly outbreak is triggered by some natural phenomenon. And then the correlating story was they just traced down, there was a number of people who were stricken in North Carolina with Legionnaires' disease, 134 people, and two people died. And the researchers trying to track down the cause of this finally figured out, if they think that it was, I think, a state fair where they had a hot tub display, and it wasn't people hopping in there. It was just the water vapor from the hot tubs, which are known to can harbor Legionnaires. People may have breathed these things in.
Oh, so there were just these cauldrons of a disease that were wafting into everybody's mouths?
Well, and there's certain diseases or bacterium that can only stay alive. Like, from what I understand, when you buy a hot tub, they sort of give you a primer on best practices, and they say, don't leave it hot all the time, because if you leave it hot all the time, then something can get cozy in there and enjoy the hotness and be not good. Like hot tub manufacturers want you to have it be hot and then not hot, because that makes it unpleasant for any of these critters to stay alive in there. That's why it's more dangerous to get into like a bacterial buffet at a hotel than it is to get in your friend's hot tub who, you know, has to take 30 minutes to fire it up.
Just because that is always, you know, at the resort, it's on all the time.
Exactly. It's on, yeah.
24 hours a day.
So it's better or worse to leave it on.
It's worse, as I understand it, to leave it on, because then you have a consistent environment for everyone to get there. And in the case of what we're describing here, not only did it grow and thrive, but it also got to catch a ride on the vapors or the water steam.
Yeah. Yeah. So gross. And, you know, I was thinking about like both these cases involved, like, you know, airborne issues and, by the way, for our listeners out there, if you haven't learned to sneeze into your arm, your elbow yet, great, great solution to stop spreading diseases. Coughing, the arm thing, whatever. Just a point.
You dab on your haters, which is also a ADA compliant way to sneeze.
Why I didn't know about that a few years ago. It was just sort of a thing that all of a sudden you just started seeing people do.
It's interesting because I saw you smiling as you said that, and I wondered, like, wait, is there news about that? Is that not the best practice? Having kids means that, you know, as they come up with new initiatives and they realize, oh, wait, sneezing in your hands are the things that you shake and you manipulate objects with and all that stuff. So I guess I first started hearing about that maybe 10 years ago when my oldest started going to public school.
Yeah, I'm glad more people do it now. You know, and that, I mean, that's, I'm glad more people do it now. And just for reminder,
I've been called out because we were taught to develop the habit of sneezing or coughing into your hands, and then somebody I didn't even know was just like, "Really, guy?" And I'm like, "Whoa!" Yeah.
but I think that that one time annoying person telling you this does make you think, oh yeah, because I can't tell you like the number of times I go to a restaurant or something, I see a worker cough into their hands and touch stuff, you know, and you're like, this is disgusting, you know, and we have this new technology of sneezing into your arm.
Yeah.
You know? It just,
I started doing it because I have like allergic reactions to like sneezing. So I have very easily triggered allergies in certain kind of environments or whatever. So I'll just like sneeze 8 times in a row and I won't be sick. It won't be a viral thing, but I'll just keep sneezing. And so I just had to figure out a way to not, because I was already drawing a ton of attention to myself. I needed to at least be hygienic while I continued disturbing everybody at this restaurant or bar.
We see, now we know that Dracula has a weakness, that he has allergies. That's why he's constantly ready to cough into his arm.
Makes sense.
I'm sorry, I have sensitivity to various plastics in your home.
Do you have a dog?
No, not a terrier. They have hair, not fur. I'm allergic to the dust, but not the dander.
Banana!
What I wonder is, could we, are we ready to, where's the technology at to develop environmental sensors, things like this, to say like, hey, let's put a lot of, put things up in your home, put things up here that are capable around you to sort of sense these sort of things. And
oh, that's interesting. Like similar to the camera revolution, where we now kind of have an expectation that maybe there's a camera on us at all times. What about cameras for other things? Like basically nose cameras, something to sniff the air and say, hey, here are the times you got sick. Here's the times that you exhibited. And it could go every, you know, I don't know. You do a thing on an Apple Watch that detects when you sneeze. Maybe there's some kind of set of muscles that flex every time you sneeze, so it keeps track of that. And then it also knows where you are. And because there are nose cameras in those places, it's like, it's been a year, and we have low fidelity data, but we figured it out. You are definitely allergic to cotton balls.
Well, you could do that, or you could do stuff. And, you know, we were dealing with that. We're dealing like, you know, chip arrays, things like this, to try to detect like bacteria and virus, things like this. You could, in theory, have environmental sensors that could say like, hey, yeah, no, there's Legionnaires in this area. There's this or there's that. And this is a bit of a technological leap, but after a few thousand people tragically died in 9/11 and we became aware of what we, you know, the threat of terrorism, we spent trillions of dollars, you know, building and investing in technologies like bomb detections and other stuff, and we're incredibly advanced that. And you wonder with the idea of, you know, airborne diseases and things like this, like, you know, billions of dollars of development there. And we could probably have really advanced tech that when cold season or flu season comes around, you know, could tell you like, oh, yeah, no, there's, the conditions here are not optimal, et cetera. So,
yeah. So what do we do with that? Once we know it's like, yeah, it's nasty, that's a bad place or whatever, I guess person by person, we could guide them and say will be a problem. Like you get your own personal, like I love the allergy forecast. I'm constantly checking out like, oh, I have a sniffles. Is that, am I getting sick? That's the big thing I want to know. Is the environment doing this to me, or is me doing this to me? And so I'll always check the allergy forecast. Man, I would love it if an Apple Watch could just say, hey, you've sneezed this many times, your temperature has gone up this amount. As best we could tell, there's nothing you're allergic to. You might be, we give you a personal sickness forecast of, you have a 35% chance of having a flu bug or whatever.
Mm-hmm. You know, I have a air filter running next to me, which got like a HEPA filter, which is great because we've had the fires and stuff, and I keep that close to when I sleep, and my sleeping has been better, air quality has been better. But you could build sensors into those things too that could just say like, hey, this is what we're picking up in your environment, you know.
And that's fascinating, because you know, you look, there's obviously a standard of that in everybody's house, which is a smoke detector. Mm-hmm. But now you could make the argument that there are far more particular elements in your house that affect your life than, you know, something like a smoke detector, which I think was probably more of an issue in a kind of bygone era where we didn't necessarily have omnipresent microwaves and air fryers and all these very time sensitive, temperature sensitive things that you're not likely to burn stuff in the same way you would in the 40s and 50s when stuff like that was starting to become more popular.
Yeah. All right. Do you want to do picks?
Yeah, I got a weird pick, and I'm excited to share it because I think it'll lead to an interesting Weird Things discussion maybe. But have you ever listened to the Gimlet Media podcast, Reply All? You ever listen to this?
I knew, but Ashley has. Ashley's a fan.
It's got one of the guys that used to work on Planet Money. They're delightful and fun to listen to. Occasionally, they do more lighthearted fare, like they'll find an absurd tech problem and like really investigate deeply on it to see kind of where it ends. This latest episode is called Feral Hogs, and it was fascinating. It's a 45-minute deep dive because it begins with, normally it's all tech-related stuff, it begins with the cultural phenomenon of, look, we already live in a world where there are mass shootings, and then predictably what happens is people virtue signal, like there's no excuse to have an assault rifle of any type on social media, and then other people respond. And in this case, somebody, a famous country star said, there's no reason to have an assault rifle. And then this other guy, who was a fan of the country music guy, said, hey, legit question. What do you do when 30 to 50 feral hogs are headed onto your property where your small children, you know, in a matter of 3 to 5 minutes, and your small children are playing out in front? And there was something just ridiculous enough about that question that it sparked a viral phenomenon of everybody saying, get a fence, dummy. But what the folks behind Reply All picked up on is, this was not a theoretical exercise. This was not a hypothetical for him. This was a real thing that happened to this guy. Mm-hmm. And so they start digging in on the phenomenon of feral hogs. And they find it, you know, they start with a history, not Cortez, but one of his other dudes came in and brought feral hogs with them. They'd have them live on the boat, set them free in the forest so they could get big and fat. And then whenever they were hungry, they would shoot one and have it. They used to be contained to one section of the U.S., but then people realized it's really fun to hunt feral hogs. And because the solution to the problem of an invasive species is fun, people were incentivized to bring feral hogs to other parts of the United States. And sure enough, now it is terrifying and sinister. Somebody described, city folk described, imagine living in New York and you understand the phenomenon of rats everywhere. Now imagine that the rats are 300 pounds and smarter than dogs, because you can't trap them more than once. You can use each trap. They're like the Borg. Once you trap one in a box, they're all like, yeah, we're not falling for that again. And so now I believe they're in like 38 states, and there are farmers who have to, in addition to doing all the work of farming, have to get up at 3:30 in the morning, do a sweep, shoot a whole bunch of hogs, and then do their farming, and then stay up late until 11:30, 12 at night to run around and shoot a bunch of hogs. And you get to this point as they exponentially grow, because the hogs are sexually fertile at 6 months, and they have litters of up to 14. So 14, and also once they have a litter, they can have another litter in 6 more months. It is the Texas kills 1 million hogs a year, and that barely keeps Texas at equilibrium. It is fascinating. And so anyway, I highly recommend the Reply All podcast, and specifically that episode.
All that free bacon out there just waiting to be had.
Well, okay. So one of the things they bring up is somebody has developed basically rat poison for these hogs. But the problem is, as long as they're huntable, if you a hog that you shoot on your land might have eaten this mega dose of rat poison from your neighbor's mm-hmm. land. And so now mm-hmm. you're feeding your kids rat poison infested hog. And so the question is, like, how do you stop it? And also, from a humanitarian standpoint, a hog being shot and killed dead within minutes is so much better than the up to days of internal bleeding, you know, blood out the eyes and ears and all the orifices as its liver explodes and all that stuff that happens with the poisoning. So it's a complicated issue. And at the beginning of the episode, he says, look, I understand that there are bigger topics than feral hogs, but feral hogs should be in the top 10 at any given moment. And I'm like, that's ridiculous. Then listening to this episode, I'm like, it should definitely be in the top 10 of things that are in the public consciousness.
You know, I'm wondering, I just did a little search here because I'm like, how far evolved are we for using drones to help with hunting? Not putting the guns on them, but just to track to figure out where
they already do.
Are.
They, as a matter of fact, there's a number of YouTube videos where they do that. Somebody sends out a drone. They with IR cameras, they're able to find the herds. They run out and they're able to bag as many of them as they can.
Right. My question was going to be how far along with actually auto hunting or having them just go out there and you just send the thing out there. And then next day you get a report of like, oh, there's game here, there's there. Because I know we use it for wildlife tracking, but it's always an operator who's doing this. But I'm wondering like I'm going to let the drone just float over my property for a while. And then I'm going to know where them damn hogs live next, tomorrow.
It reminded me a little bit of that Love, Death and Robots Netflix show, the one where all the farmers put on the mech suits and take on the alien critters coming in. Like that's real life today. That's not some kind of crazy sci-fi scenario.
Yeah. I like that episode, by the way, but I just think that's why I think I'm fascinated with the idea of drones when they just, you start letting them do more of the release and forget and let it do its thing and then come back and tell you, data stuff. Yeah. Then the having the act of like grove around and do it because it might take hours and hours to find when you're trying to find a certain thing, but be cool. Other picks?
I saw the Joker movie over the weekend.
I saw it again. I saw it a second time.
So. I'm gonna look. I know this is gonna catch me heat, man. But I'm just gonna say this: Joker, man, bad guy, bad. He's no hero in my book. This Joker, very bad.
Is this a quote from President Trump?
I'm just saying, man. I'm not. I know this will lose me support with the Bernie Bros, but no. I mean, in all seriousness, look. I thought it was a really good movie. I thought it was intensely atmospheric. I think it's very smart. I think it's certainly in that genre, one of the more unsettling movies that I've watched in recent memory. Joaquin Phoenix is awesome. And it was the first time that I ever watched a Batman movie or movie in that universe where I was like, oh God. You know what this city needs is a Batman. Like, this city needs a Batman, like, immediately. Like, not just, like, there's always that idea of, like, and they've even kind of steered into it with some of the Marvel stuff of, like, they're like, oh, like, what kind of man puts on underwear and punches bad guys or whatever? And it's, like, kind of trivializing because that's where your head kind of goes. It's like, all right, well, why would somebody do that? You watch that movie, you're like, oh no, he's necessary. Like I'm genuinely sad that there is going to be a time lapse between when we leave that movie and when there will be a Batman out there punching people. It was I think a few minor quibbles that we might be able to get into in after things, but other than that, just awesome. I thought it was great.
Cool, Bryce.
I got a pick. Netflix just got the new season, or I don't know if it's new, or I guess I don't know if it's new or if they it's like the AMC thing where they put it on because the new season's about to start on TV. But the fifth season of Schitt's Creek is on Netflix now, and that show is just a delight. I don't know. It's really sweet and it's charming, but it's also funny. I also think that this new season it might be. Justin, you watched the older episodes more recently than I have. Did mm-hmm. they use the F word in those earlier seasons? Because I didn't remember them doing it.
I don't remember, although I do know that there is like something in my head says that I watched versions that were uncensored that were either bleeped in other versions of it or... Like there was a difference between the Netflix versions that I watched and then because I think we wound up watching half of this season just buying it off iTunes.
Oh.
Because we were like, we had just gotten to the end and we were like, Portlandia, just one more episode, sort of jonesing. And so we bought them. So I don't know. Although that does seem familiar to me, Bryce, that for whatever reason, there's F words in this season.
Yeah, it was a little bit of a surprise because it's not it's a lot of like very quiet and like small uses of it, which I think is just really fun. But it manages to hold up and keep giving these people new problems and new things to overcome while also being really funny. So the CBC / pop show Schitt's Creek, Schitt apostrophe S.
Yeah, you know, it's kind of a real challenge for that show because they made the decision that they were going to have these, you know, fairly snooty to irredeemable people become increasingly more redeemable, you know, and you're going to see more and more of their heart and less of their selfishness. And at a certain point, it's like, all right, like the reason why we showed up here was so a-holes could make fun of rednecks, right? And the rednecks could make fun of the a-holes. You know, it's interesting to see how they juggle that while also keeping these characters growing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Andrew?
Double down, one on your pick last week, South Park episode Banned in China. That was great, and it was neat to see somebody flat out, you know, see them just flat out, you know, make their point about what they see as problematic about our relationship, about how we talk about China. And, you know, loved it, thought it was great, was what, you know, does proof of what South Park does really wonderfully well. And, you know, very, very critical of Disney, very, very critical of you know, and sometimes South Park, I'll watch an episode like, I don't agree with their point, but I'm glad they're saying something. But here's one like, I like what they're saying. This is great. But I always enjoy their take on stuff. And then my big pick is going to be watch the final episode of the first season of Righteous Gemstones, the HBO series.
Yeah.
Great show. That just grew and grew to where it's just one of my favorite shows, period. So
it's got it manages to get so outrageous and yet preserve so much heart, and I did not expect that on episode one. I love everybody. I love every character on this show.
Yeah. I've in the past, I think Danny McBride is brilliant, but often he plays characters that I just find they're just unlikable, and I just can't. And that was like my problem with Vice Principals. I'm like, I love these actors, but I don't like either of these people, and I do not care what happens. And so I just tuned out after like two or three episodes. Like, if they redeem themselves, they started off so awful, I didn't want to watch it. Where here, they're selfish. You know, they make bad choices, but they care about their family. They are loving people. And that's what I liked about this, was because I wanted to see people get punished for their choices, but I wanted to see them redeemed, or I wanted to see that. And I love that.
Mm-hmm. And so the season finale that I aired this week is really good. I mean, yeah. The best scene yet for Judy Gemstone. Incredible, with like the perfect button at the very end of it.
Oh, my God. I mean, she's the breakout of the show.
Oh, yeah.
There's much of a conversation. Like, she is...
Edie Patterson is the actor.
She's an absolute star. She's a star in that show, and they've had these few moments where they like, it's usually they would carve out like one or two per episode of her just having some one-liner or some weird train of thought. But boy, do they just clear the floor for a solid like 2-minute monologue that is, I mean, just next level.
Yeah. And most. Like a really, it wasn't the whole monologue wasn't one take, but there was one that 70% of it that is a very long single cut that is.
I found myself a little bit distracted. Like, how do you tell a story so funny while maintaining that? Because you have to be aware enough of the comedy to let just a little bit of that leak through, but maintain enough of the character that you get through the whole thing without messing it up.
And by the way, to the credit of the show, it's a monologue that we remember because it's hilarious, but it says there's a huge character revelation to it. Like, there's a gigantic element of who Judy Gemstone is kind of revealed in this, like, just crying, laughing monologue. And that's, I think, the hallmark of you know, the Jody Hill, David Gordon Green, Danny McBride kind of shows. And this is it at just another level.
For me, I thought it was great, but it was just two words in context that just made me pause a thing and just almost cry with laughter, and that was Chicken Magic.
And what's funny is it's a justified context. Like, I knew exactly what he was talking about, and he was not arguing from a position of ignorance. That was the best part, is that as ridiculous as that character is, like, yeah, man, I understand why you're afraid of Chicken Magic.
McBride's delivery is great, and every now and then, like, the way he sees the world and the way he thinks and says something that in the Gemstone character, car pranks, car pranks, you know,
he's just some guy I play car pranks with. It's just amazing.
And there's a meta level where it's like, the character McBride is playing is aware of story arcs and aware that in real life humans go through. He's like, all right, so I'm beginning my redemption arc because I've done. And he says all of the right words that he knows that the character is supposed to say. But there's that awareness to it. Oh, God, I just love it. It's such a great show.
Yeah. So perfect. Pick. It's been weird.
Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.